Stockholm, whereby a group of children in such an environment apparently showed increased scores on aptitude tests and accelerated growth, Maxwell was hoping to boost the health and intelligence of students in America. With the prestigious inventor wiring the walls with his Tesla coil, guaranteeing complete safety and concurring with the general conclusions of the hypothesis, Tesla helped Maxwell set up a pilot study with 50 mentally defective schoolchildren. If the study proved successful, the superintendent boldly stated, the new system would overturn all methods hitherto applied in its schools and introduce a new era in education. Marconi's talk before 1,100 members of the New York Electrical Society was held on the very day the Titanic sank. Frank Sprague, who gave the eulogy, visibly affected Mr. Marconi when he credited him with saving the lives of from 700 to 800 persons. Unfortunately, Marconi was unable to save 1,500 other individuals, including Colonel Astor, who went down with the ship after helping his new bride board one of the remaining lifeboats. If ever an event epitomized the loss of innocence, the myopic condition of humanity, it was the sinking of the Titanic. Reminiscent of Tesla's own voyage, this watershed recapitulated the story of Icarus, the prideful aeronaut who crumbled because of lack of respect for his limitations. With Tesla's outlandish wish to transmit unlimited energy to the far reaches of the world and bring rain to the deserts to become a master of the universe, it was inevitable that he too would succumb. The tragedy prompted Congress to pass into law an act requiring the use of wireless equipment on all ships carrying 50 or more passengers. It also focused national attention on 21-year-old David Sarnoff, latter-day head of RCA, who was credited as the first wireless operator to pick up the Titanic distress signal. Tesla was not the only casualty in the wireless game. Reginald Fessenden's concern all but ceased functioning in 1912 due to his erratic nature, infighting and prolonged litigation. And Lee DeForest, who by now had nearly 40 patents in wireless, also went under when he was convicted with officers of his company in a stock fraud. Concerning Lowenstein, Tesla was backing his protégé's attempts to install equipment on U.S. Navy ships using equipment based on some of his fundamental designs. "He is much abler than the rest of the wireless men," he wrote Scherf, "so this has given me great pleasure." The one edge Lowenstein had over Marconi was the Italian's insistence on an all-or-nothing deal with the military. Either all ships were hooked into his system, or none were. The U.S. government, however, was loath to relinquish their upper hand to a private concern, so Marconi had great difficulty integrating his system into the American marketplace. Nevertheless, Marconi was still the only major competitor, so Tesla set out to re-establish his legal right. Conferring with his lawyers, the pioneer began a strategy to sue the pirate in every country he could. In England, Tesla had allowed an important patent to lapse, so progress there was halted. Oliver Lodge, on the other hand, was able to prevail and received £1,000 per year for 7 years from the Marconi concern there. In the United States, where Tesla was applying for a renewal of his most fundamental patent, he had yet to formalize the suit. But in the highest court in France, the inventor achieved a resounding success. Sending his written testimony to Judge Monsieur Bonjean in Paris, Tesla explained his work in 1895 when he erected a large wireless terminal above the building and employed damped and undamped oscillations. He also enclosed two patents from 1897 and specifications for his teleautomaton, which confirmed that he had displayed it before G.D. Seeley, the examiner-in-chief of the U.S. Patent Office in Washington, D.C. in 1898. Concerning Marconi's June 2, 1896 patent, Tesla testified that the patent was but a mass of imperfection and error. If anything, it has been the means of misleading many experts and retarding progress in the right direction. It gives no hint as to the length of the transmitting and receiving conductors, and the arrangements illustrated preclude the possibility of accurate tuning. Marconi replaced the old-fashioned Ruhmkorff coil with the Tesla coil. Speaking in support of Tesla's cause for Popoff, Ducreté and Rochefort, the French company that had initiated the action, was electrical engineer Émile Girardot, who described in detail the technical accomplishments of Tesla's invention. "Indeed," Girardot began, "one finds in the American patent extraordinary clearness and precision, surprising even to physicists of today. What a cruel injustice it would be now to try to stifle the pure glory of Tesla in opposing him scornfully." Judge Bonjean struck down Marconi's patents and re-established Tesla's as superseding. Most likely compensation was also paid to him from the French company that won the case. With this victory, however, came other defeats. The year 1912 saw legal entanglements against Tesla by Edmund K. Stallo, who was seeking damages of $61,000 for advances tendered in 1906, and also the Westinghouse Corporation, which sued for $23,000 for equipment loaned out in 1907. In the first instance, the Stallo Syndicate, which had ties to Standard Oil, had invested only $3,500 and was frivolously suing for the promise of an enormous profit. The inventor's liability was thus minimal. In the second instance, Tesla argued that he was not personally liable, as the machinery was loaned to the company he was organizing. He did offer, however, to return the equipment, which was still being guarded at the Long Island laboratory. Although his financial losses were small, the negative publicity undermined his reputation and caused the inventor to become a more invisible presence at the prestigious Waldorf, where he was still residing and piling up debt. And then there was Mrs. Tierstein, who Tesla said wanted to shoot me for throwing electricity at her. Tesla pitied the poor woman, but had her sent by way of Judge Foster to the asylum. The suit by Westinghouse caused quite a stir among the inner circle, and even prompted Tom Edison to pen a rare missive of commiseration. February 24, 1912. My dear Mr. Edison, acknowledging your kind letter, I wish to reiterate the sentiments and express my great regret that I was unable to transmit them in person. With assurance of high regard, I remain as ever, N. Tesla. The Westinghouse Corporation, however, was not a monolithic enterprise, and its legal department, in some ways, was an autonomous entity. Tesla continued to borrow equipment on a regular basis throughout the period 1909 to 1917, and he frequently conferred with various engineers, particularly Charles Scott, whom he began educating in the field of wireless. Tesla also continued to meet with the recently deposed chieftain George Westinghouse, who was working in semi-retirement at his offices in New York City. I suppose you cannot help feeling disappointed at the ingratitude of some who are now heading the great enterprise which your genius has created, the inventor remarked. I sincerely hope that you will very shortly be again in the position you have heretofore occupied. I know that the large majority of the public shares my sentiments.
Thank you for your concern, the descendant of Russian noblemen replied.
The German Connection. Marconi's greatest rival in the legal arena may have been Nikola Tesla, but in the battleground of the marketplace, it was Telefunken, the German wireless concern. Although Marconi had patents in Germany, the Telefunken syndicate had too many important connections on its home front and easily maintained a monopoly there. Formed through a forced merger under orders of the Kaiser of the Braun Siemens Halske and Arco Schlabi systems, Telefunken had fought the Marconi conglomerate vigorously on every front. It was without doubt the number two competitor in the world. Although Marconi had achieved a recent coup in Spain, Telefunken gained an edge in America when it constructed two enormous transatlantic systems in Tuckerton, New Jersey, and Sayville, New York. For nationalistic reasons, Tesla had been prohibited from obtaining his rightful royalties in Germany, but Professor Adolf Schlabi never hid the fact that he considered Tesla the patriarch in the field. Thus, when Telefunken came to America, Schlabi sought out his mentor not only on moral grounds, but also for gaining a legal foothold against Marconi and to obtain the inventor's technical expertise. A meeting was held between Tesla and the principals of Telefunken's American holding company, the innocuous-sounding Atlantic Communication Company, at 111 Broadway, the location of their offices. Present was its director, Dr. Carl George Frank, one of the best-known German-American electrical experts, and his two managers, Richard Funt a frequent visitor to Tesla's lab, who was head of the Sayville plant, and the Monocle, Lieutenant Emil Myers, head of operations at Tuckerton. Tesla asked for an advance of $25,000 and royalties of $2,500 per month, but settled for $1,500 per month with a one-month advance. The inventor met with Funt to discuss the turbine deal with the Kaiser, and also to fix a transmitter that the Germans were working on at the Manhattan office. Shortly thereafter, he travelled out to the two wireless stations with his plan to institute his latest refinements in order to boost their capabilities. With Professor Jonathan Zenick out at Sayville, Tesla calculated that they were wasting nearly 25% of their energy in electromagnetic radiations. "Those waves will dissipate only a few miles offshore," he told Zenick, "whereas the energy that will reach Germany will be from your ground connection." After a grueling search along the imponderable ice field, John Jacob Astor's emaciated body was fished from the sea for a New York funeral. Documents from his estate revealed 500 shares of Tesla Electric Company. A year later, J. Pierpont Morgan, the Sultan of Wall Street, the Octopus, was dead. Considering the resentment and disillusionment the inventor felt, he also bore great admiration for the man he called a towering historical figure. Although Morgan's son-in-law, Herbert Satterlee, could only provide a back-row seat at the chapel, nevertheless, even to be present at the solemn occasion was a great honor. The hall was speckled with numerous faces of colleagues and adversaries, many of whom could track a large percentage of their wealth and even their station to Tesla's creations. No doubt the inventor endured some snickering, particularly from the Hydra's underlings, but Tesla, ever the nobleman, transcended the petty titters as he walked up to Anne and J.P. Jr. "Please accept my heartfelt condolences on the death of the great man who was head of your famous firm," he told them. "When I can feel such a void in my heart and brain at the passing of Morgan, I can appreciate in a measure the depth of feeling of those who were his lifelong comrades. All the world knew him as a genius of rare powers, but to me he appears as one of those colossal figures of the past which mark epochs in the evolution of human thought." 2 months later, within days of the termination of his relationship with Hammond, Tesla approached the new head of the House of Morgan with a proposal to help fund his bladeless turbines. "Its application to the manufacture of iron and steel alone will yield $100 million a year through the utilization of the waste heat and other economies, and it will have a similar effect on ship propulsion, railroad, automobile, and many other large industries." The monarch looked over the proposal and advanced the inventor $5,000. It was time for reflection on the death and transmutation of his nemesis. Conflicting emotions of enmity and adoration poured through his being in torrents as he relived the exhilaration of his wireless odyssey and the anguish of its incompleteness. On July the 7th, 1913, 3 days before his 57th birthday, Tesla took the train back out to Wardenclyffe. He had much to think about, for his friend Johnson had decided to retire from the Century. Overseers of the company were pressing to lower the standards. Johnson offered to create a separate magazine, which would be more flashy, but he wanted to maintain the integrity of the original. But he was outvoted. "It was really pathetic to see the way authors would plead with me for another damn," he told his friend. Catherine became more persistent in demanding that Tesla stop by for another visit. Now, in financial trouble, his friends could even lose their house. Tesla tried to scurry past the magnifying transmitter without looking up to get to the safe in the laboratory, but he was drawn like a magnet to the stalwart frame. As he grabbed a rung from the bottom tier, a sorrow swept through him that stole his breath. He staggered to the door of Stanley's building and let himself in. "I did not exactly cry when I saw my place after so long an interval," he wrote Scherf, "but came very near doing it." Tesla began to court the new Morgan, trying not to fall into the trap he had laid for himself the first time around. He sent Jack an articulate proposal outlining his wireless enterprise, an explanation of his outstanding debt, an arrangement with his father, and also his plans in the field of fluid propulsion, that is, bladeless turbines. In either of these fields, in which I have the good fortune to be a pioneer, the possibilities are immense, and I can vouch for the fullest success. But my appeal for your support is on a higher plane. The proposition which I would respectfully submit is to organize two companies and to turn over to you my entire interests in both, of which you may accord me such a part as you deem best.
I'm greatly impressed with your offer, Jack responded, but of course I could not consent to doing as you suggest. I wish to make a counter-offer, which is that you should proceed to organize your companies and, if and as they work out, repay to Mr. Morgan's estate, either in securities or in cash, the money Mr. Morgan advanced. It seems to me that you are entitled to the profits of these companies, but that Morgan would, in strict justice, be entitled to a return of his money if it could be arranged.
Tesla left the meeting with the old itch reactivated and another check for $5,000. He thanked Jack for his encouragement and forwarded an open letter which he had written to His Grace, the Most Reverend Archbishop of Ireland. The day is not distant when the very planet which gave him birth will tremble at the sound of his voice. He will harness the inexhaustible, intense energy of microcosmic movement, cause atoms to combine in predetermined forms. He will draw the mighty ocean from its bed, transport it through the air, and create lakes and rivers at will. He will command the wild elements. He will push on from great to greater deeds until, with his intelligence and force, he will reach out to spheres beyond the terrestrial.
It is now clear to me, Tesla told the new JP, that you are moved by the same great spirit of generosity which has animated your father, and I am more than ever desirous of enlisting your interest and support. Destiny has placed you in a position of great power and influence, and here is a wonderful opportunity. As for myself, the modest inventor continued, I contemplated more than financial success. A great monument will no doubt be built to Mr. Morgan, but none in marble or bronze could be as lasting as the achievement which I have proposed to link with his memory. To reassert his dominance as the preeminent inventor in wireless, the inventor forwarded a transcript of the entire French litigation proceedings wherein Marconi's work was overturned in favor of his. If Jack could help fight the legal battle in the United States, the wireless enterprise, which they contractually shared, could be revived. Jack, however, was not smitten by the same vision of destiny, and graciously declined to become involved in Wardenclyffe in any way. He had not ruled out the turbines, however, and told the inventor to keep him informed of any progress. Tesla returned to the Edison Waterside Station with a new transfusion of 23 Wall Street blood. To reflect the reactivation of the resurrected alliance, the inventor set out to search for more fashionable chambers. Within a few months, he took up residence in the brand-new Woolworth Building. Decorated with a gold-leafed emerald-colored mosaic ceiling in the lobby and located by City Hall near Wall Street on Park Row, the Gothic-styled Woolworth soared above the city to the dizzying height of 800 feet, eclipsing the Metropolitan Towers as the loftiest skyscraper in the world. Tesla took the Johnsons along to the gala opening. The banquet began with the illumination of the building's 80,000 light bulbs by President Woodrow Wilson, who pressed a button in Washington, D.C. Tesla met with the mayor, Mr. Dimestore Woolworth, and other dignitaries, and then Catherine lured her two escorts into one of the 24 high-speed elevators to the roof, where they could gaze out over the sprawling megalopolis. "Do not worry about finances, Luca," Tesla said confidently. "Remember, while you sleep, I work and am solving your problems." Johnson brought up the old AC polyphase debacle, and Tesla replied that there were billions invested in it now. "I won every suit without exception, and had it not been for a scrap of paper, I would have received in royalties Rockefeller's fortune. But, just the same, I feel I am safe to invite you to dinner." Tesla's wit and latest maneuver once again brought a needed smile to the oft-brooding Mrs. Philipoff. As usual, when the wizard returned to her orb, she seemed to step back from the veil. Johnson, however, reiterated his concern
that without a job, 327 Lexington Avenue would go on the market.
"Please take my words seriously," Tesla insisted. "Do not worry, and write your splendid poetry in perfect serenity. I will do away with all difficulties which confront you. Your talent cannot be turned into money, but mine is one which can be transformed into carloads of gold. This is what I'm doing now."
During this period, Tesla continued to pay back monies owed the Johnsons as he labored with his new engines. Throughout the latter half of 1913, the inventor prepared a careful marketing plan to exploit his new device. Not only would he show Hammond that he had made a costly mistake, he would also set up an industry that would ensure the finances necessary to return to his beloved Long Island tower. His best leads came from the Ford Motor Company in the United States and the Bergmann Works in Germany. Tesla had known Sigmund Bergmann since his first days in America. Bergmann had emigrated from Germany even before Tesla and became a valued employee, private partner, and manufacturer for Thomas Edison. Maintaining a separate company from the other Edison works, Bergmann became highly successful. He returned to Germany in the early 1900s, becoming one of the leading manufacturers for the Kaiser, a man who had also attempted to woo the Serb, especially before the turn of the century when he was demonstrating his fantastic inventions in Europe and America. In September, Tesla forwarded photographs of his turbines and invited Morgan to the waterside station to see them in person. However, Morgan was sailing for Europe. "Perhaps when I return sometime in December," Morgan replied, "it will be possible for me to go into the question." While the new Wall Street Tsar sailed for the Old World, Tesla set up meetings with emissaries from the most consequential markets. In a letter sent to Morgan upon his return, Tesla outlined his numerous strategies for achieving financial success. His list included 1. A sale of exclusive license for Belgium through the advisor of the king for $10,000 cash and fair royalty. 2. Concessions for Italy through an associate at Crispi for $20,000 and royalty, not yet consummated. 3. Exclusive license for the U.S. to the Wing Manufacturing Company for turbo draft blowers. 4. Exclusive license for train lighting, Dressel Railway Lamp Works. 5. Manufacture of automobile lighting with engine exhaust gas. 6. Use of my wireless system with Lowenstein on several battleships. 7. Agreement with L.C. Tiffany Company on new invention. 8. Prospective agreement with Mr. N. E. Brady of the Edison Company in regard to the manufacture of turbines. Very good chance for big business. Manufacturing had begun at some of these places, and royalty contracts were negotiated with most. "As you can see, Mr. Morgan, here are decidedly valuable results, very gratifying to me, but on the other hand, I am almost despairing at the present state of things. I need money badly, and I cannot get it in these dreadful times. You are about the only man to whom I can look for help. I have stated my case." Morgan agreed to defer interest payments on the amount, which was now up to $20,000, but decided not to increase the loan. Tesla, however, simply required the funds, and followed up the letter with a testimonial from Excellence von Tirpitz, Minister of Marine, who has been requested to the German Emperor relative to the Tesla turbine, who is greatly interested in this invention. Von Tirpitz had promised His Excellency that the machine will certainly be here on exhibition about the middle of January, so you know what that means. Tesla also informed Morgan that if the deal was consummated, Bergmann would come through with royalties on the turbine of $100,000 per year. Considering Jack's keen antipathy for the Germans, their connection to the Jewish banking houses, he was notoriously anti-Semitic, and the long-standing policy of the House of Morgan to shun financial arrangements with Germany after they had double-crossed Pierpont many years before, it would seem unlikely that Jack would reverse his decision. However, unlike his father, the son was able to compromise and allow his heart to rule at times. He graciously changed his mind and forwarded the additional funds. As Tesla awaited news from the Bergmann Works, he labored to perfect a new speedometer he had invented. The device, much simpler than the one then being used, would cost half as much to produce and had a market in the hundreds of thousands. Considering that his selling price would be around $25 each, the potential for large profits was great, and Tesla offered the deal to Morgan. Jack declined and asked again for the interest payment due on the loan. "In the turbine proposition," Tesla replied, "I have received a painful setback. I installed the machine at the Edison plant and made some very gratifying tests, but soon discovered that the castings of the bearings were full of small holes which allowed the water to enter and made it hazardous to run. Tesla had to renew the part, but spent considerably more money than expected. He also had lawyer's fees to contend with because of the upcoming suit with Marconi, so he requested that Morgan either be patient or help with the bills to complete the turbine project or protect their other common interest. Besides the deaths of Astor and Pierpont Morgan, this period also marked the departure of two other lions from Tesla's den, George Westinghouse and naturalist John Muir. Both men died in 1914. Westinghouse's death was cushioned by some weeks of declining health, but Muir's passage took Tesla by surprise. He seemed so vigorous in mind and body when I saw him not long ago, the technological conservationist told the Johnsons. Only a few years before, the sky had been blanketed with hundreds of thousands of passenger pigeons, and the beauty of nature had been rekindled with Muir's inspirational writings. As Tesla strolled to his favorite spot by the 42nd Street Library to spread seed among the bird's domestic cousins and consider a new tack for instituting his wireless scheme, the last passenger pigeon disappeared from the earth. Jack Morgan spent time with one of the few Jews he liked, Daniel Guggenheim, organizing Kennecott Copper, America's biggest copper producer. Tesla sent his tribute to Westinghouse to Electrical World. It was published with the comments of other colleagues, such as William Stanley, Lewis Stillwell, and Frank Sprague. "I like to think of George Westinghouse as he appeared to me in 1888 when I saw him for the first time. The tremendous potential energy of the man had only in part taken kinetic form, but even to a superficial observer the latent force was manifest. An athlete in ordinary life, he was transformed into a giant when confronted with difficulties which seemed insurmountable. He enjoyed the struggle and never lost confidence. When others would give up in despair, he triumphed. Had he been transferred to another planet with everything against him, he would have worked out his salvation. His was a wonderful career filled with remarkable achievements. He was a great pioneer and builder, whose work was of far-reaching effect on his time and whose name will live long in the memory of men." 40. Fifth Column, 1914 to 1916.
Navy Department, Washington, D.C. September 14, 1916. Sir, in the files of the Bureau of Steam Engineering is found a copy of a letter by Nikola Tesla to the Lighthouse Board under date of September 27, 1899, from the experimental station Colorado Springs. This letter is evidently an answer to a communication from the Lighthouse Board requesting information as to Tesla's ability to supply wireless telegraph apparatus. This letter may be made use of in forthcoming litigation in which the government is involved, as the discovery of suitable proof of priority of certain wireless usages by other than Marconi might prove of great aid to the government. Sincerely yours, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Acting Secretary of the Navy.
Within 2 weeks of the beginning of World War I, Germany's transatlantic cable was severed by the British. The only reasonable alternative for communicating with the outside world was through Telefunken's wireless system. Suddenly, the Tuckerton and Sayville plants became of paramount concern. The Germans obviously wanted to maintain the stations to keep the Kaiser abreast of President Woodrow Wilson's intentions, but the British wanted them shut down. In March 1914, Marconi was made a senatore in Italy, a distinguished man of science, and he spoke before the royal couple. In July, in Great Britain, the land of his mother, he was decorated by the King at Buckingham Palace. Now the fight against Telefunken would be fought on military as well as commercial grounds.